Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is part two of chapter six of Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life, by David Cohen. Got a bit of a sore throat, and you can hear some parrots in the background. Unfortunately, one of the trees behind us has gone into bloom. I suppose you have trees overseas which go into bloom, but this tree goes into bloom twice in a month. Once a year, twice in a month. I think it's the female, then the male, a month apart, and the parrots have a field day each time. Okay. Now, we've talked about the Greeks, and the sort of key person I sort of remember, well, obviously, is Thales, which I knew information about. He's got Parmenides incorrect, as far as I can see, from what I've studied. But we've got this interesting person called Anaxagoras, who saw a meteorite fell, and then when he said, that came from above, there's rocks up there somehow. He got deemed to be an atheist and sent into exile. So that's an interesting thing. So I have to remember that man now. It's not in my memory banks, so to speak. Now, we've done Plato. So there's the golden era with the death of Socrates. Then there's Plato in his academy. Plato, we find out, is Greek for buff, a broad-shouldered, good wrestler type of person. That's what Plato means. He set up his academy. Aristotle is the next person after Plato, and he's going to set up his Lyceum, and which is a temple to the shepherds. So academia comes from a guy, and Lyceum comes from the word shepherd, and there's a third institution. So the plot thickens, and it's worthwhile having a good listen and a think about what the complexity of ancient Greece is equally as complex their system of spheres as their... this is another thing about Greece, is that they said, well, let's get a mechanism up and running. They had a cosmic engine, so to speak, had a mechanism up and running. Whereas people just said, God did it. They were on the start, on the road towards science. Okay. So, here's page 95 of some 580 pages to go. So it's a fifth of the way through the book. Aristotle, whose name translates as best objective, born in Stagira, the north of Greece, in 384 BC. Now, you've got to remember that Greece was not occupied originally by the Greeks, and it was invaded by several waves. And but it's strange that the northern Greeks are the newcomer Greeks, because they're from the latest wave of migration, but the more ancient Spartans have come down there. And even Spartans weren't the first wave of migration into Greece. So it's a complex thing to understand. So you've got to understand that there was... even though they had a very small society, 75,000 people active, there were still great fault lines in it between merchants and noble people, slaves and non-slaves, people from different parts of Greece. If they could find a fault line, they'd find it. And of course, they hated each other. It's excellent. By the time he was 10, both his parents were dead. At 17, he was sent to the academy, staying for almost 20 years, becoming so much a star that Plato called him the mind of the school. Possibly inspired by his father, who had been a court physician to the king of Macedon, he first concentrated on medicine, biology, zoology, soon advancing from pupil to teacher and lecturing in almost every subject. It's great, wouldn't that be? It would be great just to hang around in there and no textbooks or anything like that. When Plato died, he was succeeded by his nephew, Cepisippus, his intellect, Aristotle's disdained, and I think we disdain because we've got very few writings of this person. Possibly piqued, maybe keen to widen his horizon, he certainly was aware of the mounting animosity towards the Macedonians who had recently conquered Athens. He chose exile to the school on the Aegean island of Assos. When his patron, ruler of Assos, was betrayed and crucified by the Persians, he fled to nearby Lesbos until he was invited to tutor the unruly son of Philip II of Macedon, the future Alexander the Great. So let's unplug a few of these things. So the Macedonians, you talk about waves, they're just... You know, I think Macedonians actually don't consider them Greek, you know, themselves Greek. But it was this continuous thing, and this is yet the latest instalment of Nolivimus coming in and making a fuss. And so he was a northerner, so it's sort of like someone from the north of England, and sort of northern people with northern accents. They spoke Greek, but they had a Greek with a northern accent. And you can imagine, if you had been, made the transition into the Southern Greek society, and then, the Northern Greeks actually did come on because animosity. So he went off. Now, the other interesting thing is that he went off and conducted biological studies and, solved the chicken and egg problem, by discovering embryos. The age-old problem is the problem that Aristotle solved, and it's his spectacular solution of chicken and egg problem and embryos which got him the gig. In about 335 BC, he turned to Athens, possibly with money from Alexander, founded his own school, the Lyceum, near the temple of Apollo Lysias, god of the shepherds. There you go, Lyceum. His followers, known as the Peripatetics, taken from their master's habit of strolling down the covered walkway, the peripatos, while he lectured. His students came from prosperous merchant landowning families, and keen rivalries developed between the Lyceum and the Academy, which is largely aristocratic body. So it's basically... the academy would be your private school, and this is a bit more of a public upstart school. And the school of political theorists, the Isocrates, which catered to Greeks new to the city. So, look at that. Okay, so I didn't realize that. Isocrates, they're new to the city. So, Isocrates. The academy's mathematics, politics, and metaphysics. And the Lyceum is a natural scientist. Oh, Isocrates' strength is in rhetoric. So that's just annoying the shit out of people, as far as I can see. By the time the Pythagorean... by this time, the Pythagorean notion of two sources of light, a central fire with the sun, a mere reflector, had been discredited. But its sister idea of several interconnecting crystalline spheres revolving around the earth had been seized upon and developed. Exodus of Sinders in what's now southwest Turkey, who was teaching in Athens when Aristotle arrived, argued that the universe comprised of not two spheres but 27 spheres. So it's, you know, who gets the most spheres? So Aristotle would obviously have to, not the 27, and no one knows 27 anymore. This elaboration enabled him to explain why four of the planets sometimes came to a stop, then reverse course and move westward, retrograde motion. They appear to move westward, but what really is that the Earth is travelling faster through space, and so our platform is moving. So it's like, you know, if you're not looking, scenery appears to go backwards out of your train. The phenomenon of retrograde motion. Each planet path, he argued, was that of a hippopede, the name taken from the figure-eight-shaped rope of hobbling horses' hooves. So if you want to get a horse, you wrap it around, in, around, like V-ray. This series also makes sense of the Moon and other planets travelling along approximately the same path as the Sun, but then deviating south and north. Invited to lecture at the Lyceum, Exodus. Okay, so he's there. So Aristotle, Quaternion, postulated that the stars and planets were fixed on shells of 27 spheres, which, transparent and thus invisible, encircled the Earth. One carried the Sun, which completed its transit every 24 hours to bring about one day. Another slowly rotated the Earth about its axis, by which it was attached to a larger sphere, the rotation establishing a year. The axis of the newly posited sphere, titled relative to the outer neighbour, was moved the Sun down the sky at winter and up at summer. So it's getting pretty close. So if you didn't know better, you'd think this is better. Aristotle went further, proposing that the heavens were made of 55 such bodies. Okay, so you can imagine. And that's basically what Aristotle did, was that people lecturing, in the academy, four elements. The Lyceum, five elements. So many spheres, in general. We've got 55 spheres. There was this one-upmanship coming across. All rotating around the Earth at different but constant speeds, which makes one think of some circus high wire acrobat spinning plates. His idea was that there could never be an empty space in heaven, and that nature abhors a vacuum. What a load of crap. Sorry. And spaces between spheres in the universe had to be filled. The greater the number, each sphere nestling with those immediately above and below it, would do the job nicely. Now, I should say that the physics sense of vacuum has a whole lot of properties associated. We've got virtual particles popping in and out of it. It's got a dielectric strength and a permissivity for magnetic fields, both of which determine our vacuum having has a speed of light in it. So the vacuum, our box of vacuum, is different from a box of vacuum that the Greeks were thinking of. Our vacuum has got properties with it. And it expands, and our vacuum, our box of emptiness changed shape with the stuff around it. And there's a scalar field of Higgs particles through it. It's really interesting. The Earth was completely surrounded by rotating spheres, like a core of an onion. Beyond all these spheres, Aristotle envisioned yet one more, the prime mover. Not to be confused with the creator of the universe, but still, the dynamic force that drove all things. This tortured web of elaboration satisfies the world's astronomers for centuries, until the invention of the telescope. We've got other fantasy things rocking around the place. But it's also interesting that the prime mover sounds a bit like God, but obviously if you read Aristotle, it's not God. Yep, but for people reading it, they're saying, well, come on, sort of like the Marvel Universe, who is the prime mover? The whole structure was based more on a priori philosophical speculation than empirical observation. So Aristotle underpinned it with logic. As best he could. The universe is spherical, he reasoned, because all shapes a sphere, which looks the same no matter where it is viewed from, is the most perfect. Earth, too, has to be a sphere, as proved by the moon's face being overrun by curved darkness during an eclipse. Furthermore, travellers north and south do not see the same stars at night as those who do stay at home, nor do stars appear to occupy the same positions in the sky. So terrestrial journeys, it must be over a curved surface. Okay, that's pretty amazing. Why the Earth should be the centre of the universe was explained by its uniqueness and immobility. While an understanding of gravity was millennia away. Aristotle argued the Earth's heavier elements, rocks, soil and water, were of the same nature drawn towards the centre of the universe, where they came together to shape in the shape of a sphere. The light elements, air and fire, intrinsically moved. I don't think soil is one of his elements. What is it? Earth. He's got rock and soil mixed together here. Echoing intrinsically moved upwards in weight, so this is why smoke moved upwards, and you have this going a long time. It's also interesting that a lot of kids have this idea. Echoing Plato, he added that heavenly bodies were not made up of these four elements, but of ether. So it should be a ether, which he named because of, it was with the quintessence, more divine or prior to the four in our uniquely changeable world that lies under the wandering moon. That's a quote. This ether was neither heavy nor light, but ageless, unutterable, impassive, free from suffering. A key to the construct of Greek astronomy passed into unceasing circular motion to bring each heavenly body back to its starting point, enforcing internal recurrence. So this is above the moon you have the dominance of the ether, and the ether creates circular movement. Now, we removed a lot of that, but people still believe the ether for a long time, right up into the 20th century. There are obvious flaws in the explanation. For example, each planet, the Sun, and the Sun attached to its sphere must always be the same distance from the Earth. Yet the Moon appeared to change size way up to almost a sixth. Yet the Moon's got an elliptical orbit. It comes in and wobbles, and you can actually see more than 180 degrees of the Moon because it sort of tilts from side to side and see above and below. Libation. Libation is different from precession. It's quite interesting. So libation is your rotation and elliptical motion put together. Another indication planets weren't distance from Earth, it was not constant, was their brightness, especially that of Mars, was variable. Transient, mutable phenomena such as the comets and meteors were assumed to be atmospheric occurrences, taking below the orbit of the Moon. That is, the atmosphere extends up to the orbit of the Moon, and then it's heavens above. Transient, okay. Exodus and Aristotle, for some reason, ignored all of this, as well as the fluctuations in the apparent velocity of the Sun. But what Exodus did discover, and Aristotle appreciated, was the motion of the planets could be explained by combining uniform rotation of concentric spheres on inclined axis. At least in respect of geometrical model building, this marks the beginning of scientific astronomy. Yeah, the other point is that the spheres were not centred on the Earth. Spheres were at a point, had to be positioned a point above the Earth. So I don't know where the Greeks got to that point. Following Alexander's death in 323 BC, so this is 23 years, you have the entire Alexander the Great. Blows my mind away. So Alexander the Great really, in effect, happened since the year 2000. It's just astonishing. Anti-Macedonian agitation drove Aristotle from the city for a second time, and he died the following year in Calais, in Eudubia, leaving behind his prototype, modern university, library, zoological garden, a museum of natural history, an unparalleled body of work. He said is to have spent his honeymoon collecting specimens of marine life. So there's a few honeymoons stories which are worth relating, not of Aristotle, but the honeymoon of Sir Humphrey Davies is a classic. But the thing is that a lot of the tablets brought back to Greece was Aristotle. Part of setting up a career in competition to the academy. The academy didn't take money, so therefore they had donations instead. So Alexander the Great wanted to repay Aristotle, and so just sent back heaps of anything scientific. He just shipped back to Greece, and plant samples. He said, well, I'd like a few plant samples, and he just got thousands and thousands of plant samples and animals, and with so many of them, he had to begin sorting them, which is sort of the start of the modern zoological gardens coming back. It's also interesting that Aristotle developed, or the school had developed, silent reading. Now, given that books were not, you know, you might be lucky if you were a student to be given one or two books, and you'd be taught to read aloud and left them. So everyone used to read aloud, except Alexander the Great. He could read silently. This is something to talk about a bit later on. His strengths were not in mathematics or physics, and he undertook no astronomic observation. Yet his influence on this, as in other sciences, was profound. He systematized the whole, and basically he wrote textbooks. Okay. Approach to learning, and settled the principles governing research, collecting a mass of data with deductions that could be drawn. Okay, this is the important thing. This is your pre-research data before the very first part of your PhD, whatever it is, whether you do a literature review, he did a science review, and you don't do experiments. That's the main thing. You don't do experiments. And this is why it's pre-science. So it was purely inductive logic, deductive logic. So deductive logic is where you propose a new theory and you test whether that new theory is valid or not. Inductive logic is from two truths, a third is born. Even as he advanced his beliefs, however, his almost exact contemporary, Heraclides of Pontus, it is his exact contemporary. Okay, they died within days of each other, so he must have died at a certain time, who had studied under Plato, but lived in the southern coast of the Black Sea, is said to have suggested that Mercury and Venus might revolve around the Sun, not Earth, and also that Earth might rotate daily on its axis, despite appearances to the contrary. He went on to assert the Sun caused winds, which in turn brought about high and low tides. A younger astronomer, Theophrastus, speaking like gods, isn't that good? A nickname given to him by Aristotle of Erastus of Lebos, discovered sunspots, though we have no idea how. Aristotle will designated him as his successor. Well, there you go. You can mention Lesbos is where they went to after that other place. His other ruler got crucified. And so that gives you an idea that Jesus wasn't the first person crucified. Just see if I can get the name of that. It's Assos. A-S-S-O-S. Great place to be crucified on. And so this is an interesting thing, that crucifixion was something. In terms of an execution, it's too quick. You might miss it. A crucifixion goes on for perhaps days, where a person's yelling, and it really burns it into the. It's really punishing the people as well as much as anything else, and it's the fact that you have this taboo. Someone is suffering. You have this urge to help someone, and so it really actually is a thing of power. It's a torture, but it's also a torture of power. It means that, you know, you have this instinct to help someone and they're suffering, and so by crucifying someone, you actually mean that everyone feels guilty of actually killing the bloke because he didn't stop it. I sort of understand that. So discovering sunspots is pretty phenomenal. Early in the 3rd century, one of the most remarkable of all Greece's astronomers, Aristus of Samos, who was to discover precession. He also calculated the ratios of the sun diameter to the Earth between 19 to 3 and 43 to 6. So each of those are out by, put that by a factor of 3, 15. Well, not 15, yeah, 15. And 6 and 2, 12. So he's out by a factor. Okay, because it's 1 to 100. How could such a large, so large a body of revolve around a smaller one? A few years later, he made the world-shattering, or at least earth-demoting association, that a globe was to go around the sun, not the other way around, and that, apart from the moon, the other planets did too. The earth, not the heavens, turned daily, and it made the complete circle of the sun in the course of a year. The sun, along with its fixed stars, did not move, so this, although we say Copernicus, it's just that Copernicus rediscovered the work of Aristus of Samos. A Stoic astronomer in Athens promptly branded him an atheist and circulated a tract charging him with having set the half of the cosmos in motion. Otherwise, this new theory, so momentous in its implication, was buried. So, I've got to understand, I've got to recall what Stoicism is, or the Stoic philosophers are. There's the, what is it, the skeptics, that's the skepticism. There's the one, I'm just trying to remember, that there's people who believe in dogs. There's Diogenes, a pretty amazing person. This may seem odd, given that Aristotle's description was not only built on discoveries and investigations that had been in train since the 6th century BC, but also resolved a whole array of problems such as retrograde movement. However, if the Earth truly moved, Aristotle's theory of falling bodies would be undermined without any compensating theory to take its place, and if we were living in just another planet, what would become of the terrestrial-celestial dichotomy implicit in the majesty of the heavens? So you can see that people didn't move forward because there were unknown things. Gravity only worked because of Aristotle's theories. Aristotle's theories had explained so many things. So this really explains people's reluctance to take out new things. And although the heavens really invite, at first, lateral thinking, it's amazing how lateral thinking then gets welded into political thinking and becomes more. The initial lateral wild child guesses are pretty wrong. As Aristarchus himself had to admit, there was nothing to be seen in the world around to suggest the earth had moved. Surely, if it did, it would hurl people against each other. Clouds and birds would be left behind. Things would be pitched off. Common sense dictated that he was wrong. Reinforced by the prejudice that man must surely live at the centre of creation, then there was the doctrines of astrology, that at the time still respected as a science, which also required a fixed central Earth. All in all, there seemed many good reasons for keeping the Earth at the centre. Whether or not the hypothesis of the solitary astronomer working on his own ever reached them, the so-called Hellenistic philosophers, i.e. those who practiced in the centuries after Aristotle and Alexander's death, decided to leave matters and the earth where they were. Beautifully written, isn't this so beautiful? The sun was important, but the earth was much more so. If difficulties emerged to which science had no answer, they should not threaten the status quo. No, one wonders whether some harbored doubts. For most astronomers of the time, science existed to support the conviction that humanity inhabited the universe of manifest order and design. But as Durant writes, and we're going to do a quote from it, but this is so much so. People will say, science is all okay, but what does it do for me? Or what does it do to society? These people come up with these new directives to CSIRO, to direct CSIRO to national objectives. It makes sort of sense, but it sort of misses the big grand picture of what science is able to do. And you really should unfetter it so that they vetted science and their own beliefs with these restrictions. Since the organisation of religious groups resumes a common and stable creed, every religion sooner or later comes into opposition with that fluent and changeful current of secular thought that we confidently call progress and knowledge. In Athens, the conflict was not always visible on the surface and did not directly affect the masses of the people. The scientists and philosophers carried their work without explicitly attacking the popular faith and often mitigated the strife by using old religious terms as symbols or allegories for their new beliefs. Only now and then did, as in the indictment of Anaxagoras, did the struggle come out into the open and come a matter of life and death. So what did this person do? He was chucked. Anaxagoras was the person who was going to be killed for seeing the rock fall out of the sky. The next figure of substance was Hipparchus of Nicaea, who had been called the greatest astronomer of antiquity, even though he stayed firmly in the geocentric orthodoxy. So he's the one who's given us the five orders of stars. So 1 to 5 orders of stars gives you a factor of 100. And things had changed because no one wanted to change it. It's pretty amazing. Operating in 130 BC from his observatory in the island of Rhodes, okay, there's an asterisk here. The centre of a flourishing sun cult, Rhodes, devoted its quadrennial festival with athletic games, and most important being a chariot race, erected for famous Colossus, one of the seven wonders of the world, in 284 BC. So I'm just trying to work all this out. Okay. The figure of the sun god towered 150 feet only to collapse in an earthquake of 218 BC. It took 900 camels to haul away the wreckage. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? There's sun god, the Colossus of Rhodes. It was a sun god. There you go. Sun worship. It's amazing. What the heck is Greece doing? How did it operate? Big question. Not too many pages. Oh, fair few pages left, my mate, my friend. Oh. With six, so he determined the length of the solar year to within 6 minutes of accuracy and made numerous calculations of the sun's diameter. He mapped some 850 stars, crucial without defining positions in the sky. Mathematical astronomy is impossible, and devised a scale divided into six ranges of intensities that made their brightness. Even today, no one is able to improve on it. Well, no one wants to, but that's a first order magnitude star, and it goes down to sixth order. So you're struggling. So in the city you can see 1 to 3. In the outback you can see 1 to 8. So accurate was his mapping that he had to accept Aristarchus' discovery of precession when his calculation indicated the stars were not quite fixed in relation to the sun. Ever committed Aristotelian, he set out to explain the apparent circular motions of the main celestial bodies in a way that would make sense without upsetting the geocentric theory. Aware that the seasons were not of equal length, he had the sun revolve at uniform speed, but he moved the earth from the centre of its path, then suggested that it was how the plane of the sun motions lined up with the earth's axis that determined the timing of both the solstice and equinox. He remains the best example of how astronomers tortured their reasoning to keep the earth where the ancient world wanted it. Isn't that beautiful writing? Hipparchus's long productive life ended around 120 BC with a long Greek tradition of astronomical observations and speculations. Ended with him. Okay, after him there's nothing more. Rome was ascendant and uninterested in the heavens. It would take over 200 years for another outstanding astronomer to appear. Long before Hippocrates, the great successors of the states of Macedonian Empire from Greece to Iraq had been conquered by the Roman empires. Wow, I find that a bit hard to calculate. Okay. It's a lot long after, I would have said. because Rhodes was not conquered. I don't quite understand. So he was in Rhodes. I find this hard to understand. Most members of the Roman elite were suspicious of Greek scientific learning, its medicine aside. But the last years of the Roman Empire, a measure of astronomical knowledge was at least considered a basic aristocratic educational requirement. But a study was accepted only insofar as it could be applied to literature. It's sort of like now, you need some science so you can be literate. Did it help towards a better understanding of a poem? In the empire of some 50 million people, the number of natural philosophers of Rome itself became too small for any fruitful collaboration, leading to a decline in scientific knowledge and generality, which also says, if you stuff science, if you just underfund it till it screams, you're just going to be left with a shell. There's virtually no solar astronomy of great value by an Italian-born scientist for over 900 years, i.e. No, he's not even getting up to Aristotle. Galileo. The historian of science, Timothy Ferris, says of the Romans, quote, "Theirs was a non-scientific culture, you betcha. It's more like the Australian yobbo culture. Rome revered authority, science heeds no authority but that of nature. Rome's excelled in the practice of law, science values novelty over precedent." Isn't that beautiful? "Rome was practical and respected technology, but science at the cutting edge was as impractical as painting and poetry. Roman surveyors did not need to know the size of the sun in order to tell the time by consulting a sundial, nor did the pilots of Roman galleys concern themselves overmuch with the distance of the moon as long as it lit their way." Isn't that beautiful? It sort of says what's on today. "It's an irony of history that while Rome was turning its back on the heavens, one part of the empire was celebrating the last major figure of the period, Ptolemy. Claudius Ptolemaeus, AD 90 to 168 AD, was an Egyptian geographer and astronomer who flourished for some 40 years in Canopus." Okay. And there is a star called Canopus. "Some 15 miles east of Alexandria. Nicely rendered by the iconoclastic historian Dennis Rawlins as the infamous licentious town, which is the ancient combination of one Hollywood and Lourdes." So it's really, I would say, like, sounds like Vegas to me. Vegas in Egypt. Oh, and he says, and Las Vegas. There you go. "He left four works, any one of which would place him among the most important authors of the ancient world. Syntaxis Mathematica, better known in the Arabic title, the Amalgus, a 13-volume book of data about the stars. Terra Biblos, the Bible of the astrologer, which he begins by distinguishing between two modes of studying the heavens, mathematical astronomy and horoscopic astrology, harmonics, and relates the musical harmonies to the properties of mathematical proportions derived from the harmonies he considered to exist throughout the universe, and Geographer, a compilation of what was known about the world at the time." So, okay, this is interesting. This, I also agree with this. "Books then were more like scrolls of necessity, brief affairs corresponding to a modern day substantial chapter. Liber means a unit of writing and not a unit of creation, a book in our present day sense. So it's not impossible for someone to have written several dozen books in one lifetime. Livy authored some 127 chapters, Caesar's opponent Vaccaro's book totaling 490. Yet modern terms just 200 to 250 pages. By contrast, Henry James authored some 40 books, few of them slim. But then every generation throws up at least one person who cannot stop writing." So, this is the entire thing. And this also really aggravates me in terms of Plato's Republic. It's not a huge book. It is deep. These books that people miss, they're just not hard to read. You could read the classics in there. In a couple of days, I would expect. Nealmagus, Ptolemy suggests that the planets moved in circles within other circles, with the Earth at the very centre. Oh, I don't think he says at the very centre. I think there's spaced up. But it could be different. Ptolemy may be different from... who's that other chap? Hipparchus. He concluded the Sun was about 1,200 Earth's radii from us. 1/19th of the actual figure. Essentially the same estimate accepted during the whole of the Middle Ages. At one point, he does consider the Sun-centered universe, but discards it after all. Where was the evidence? But he does hold that one of the two main composite motions of each planet is governed by its relation to the Sun, which made the conversion to heliocentricity much easier when it came. That's interesting. So he said the orbit speed is... Oh, this is so confused. When the alchemist appeared, critics charged that he had lifted large sections from Hipparchus and that several observations were fabricated. At one point, he does unwittingly assign two quite different dates, 37 days apart, to the same celestial event. And there are many other instances of sloppy research and borrowed ideas. But if he was a fraud, he did a hopeless job of covering his tracks. And his achievement is better seen from a different perspective. Well, there you go. Ptolemy was a fraud. He was like a Vegas wedding man. In his History of Astronomy, Colin Rowan points out that during these years, scholarship was primarily in the reminiscent mood, collating and reassessing the achievements of previous generations, which is absolutely so true. Ptolemy was a supreme collator, though. The Alchemist contains errors not credited to the 17th century. A huge number of tables he created were sufficiently accurate to be taken by Copernicus, never a sophisticated observer of the skies. The Alchemist shares with Euclid's elements, which list laid down the basis of geometry. The distinction of being one of the two mathematical texts in longest use. It was Ptolemy's thinking that set the course of astronomy for the next 1,500 years. Well, that's a refreshing. This is that you get really no original thinkers after a while, which is, you can't really blame them because there's no journals. People only wanted screenplays, only want revisions. They only wanted easy reads. Sort of like you can't put a new philosophy in an airport lounge. Ptolemy regarded his work as part of an ongoing inquiry, but it was treated as a successor. His successors as definitive. Okay, by his successors as definitive. If, as seems most likely, he came up with his theory of orbits within orbits in order to maintain the Earth at the centre of the universe, then he in turn had to shape his observations to fit this theory. He might almost not have bothered. Rules and ever more powerful. Because he was fated to be the one in. Rulers and ever more powerful Christian church dignitaries. Their views reinforced by using the importance of Christian idea that the doctrine counted for more than knowledge, which is interesting. We're becoming sceptical of the value of looking into the heavens. With Ptolemy's death, as Roland put it, the light of astronomy research went out throughout Western Europe for 1,000 years. No astronomers in the civilization made any significant advance in what he had done. Conditions for scientists began to worsen, and it was not until the Middle Ages where Ptolemy's ideas revived, as the philosophy of Aristotle was wedded to medieval theology in the great synthesis of Christian faith, an ancient region undertaken by such theologians as Aquinas. I love Thomas Aquinas. So he comes up with the choirs of angels, the stars, he just come with angel time. I just love him. Okay, he's just such a great person to read. The prime mover of Aristotle's universe, while never conceived by him as the cause of all creation, fed into the god of Christian theology. The atmosphere of the prime mover became the cosmological embodiment of Christian vision of heaven. Okay, isn't it beautiful? The central position of the earth was interpreted as a sign of the Christian God's concern for mankind. Thereafter, it served the church not to study the heavens too carefully. Isn't that amazing? And this is pretty much like the syllabus at the moment is complete crap, but it serves the state perfectly okay. This is our current science syllabus. Astrology was the leading discipline of the time. Fortune telling became an obsession and lasted through the centuries. And its connections to the alchemy and number of symbolisms were to become important elements in both Christian and Muslim Arab thinking. Anisha was to ask, quote, "Do you believe that the sciences would ever have arisen and become great had there not been beforehand magicians, alchemists, astrologers, and wizards who thirsted and hungered over obscure forbidden powers?" Rome's leaders were no exceptions. In the days before, he accepted the sobriquet of Augustus the Increaser, the Emperor Victorious General. Caesar's great nephew and successor, Octavian, was converted to astrology. When leading a practitioner, examined his horoscope and immediately knelt in worship of him. He saw as the future sovereign. Isn't that pretty amazing? Of course you would, wouldn't you? If you want to get paid a lot of money, you'd do that. But it is Augustus. He clad Roman marble. Although the adopted son of Augustus, Tiberius, banished all astrologers from the capital, he privately continued to depend on them. Nero, too, was officially skeptical, but had one Barbalus read the heavens to discover his enemies, whom he promptly executed. These years and centuries that followed were periods of regression as astronomical observation and investigation became subservient to sun worship, and false prophets abounded. Tullian, the convert, a lawyer from Carthage, wrote, "As for us, curiosity is no longer necessary," which is the fundamental thing. Why do you need science? Why do we need STEM? All this type of stuff. It is interesting that Hipparchus came from a sun god worship place. How it happens, I don't understand. Here astronomy came to theology's age. Ptolemy's theory survived the collapse of the Roman West for their technical quality, their coherent picture of the cosmos, the usefulness to astrology, and their harmony with Christian teaching. It's interesting that it was that if they had discovered science, full-on science, it wouldn't have gone through. It's the Greek science was just whack enough to be picked up by the Christianity. The systems outlined by Pythagoras, refined by Plato and Aristotle, given a final form by Hipparchus and recorded by Ptolemy, promoted, as Franz Kalmus says, a divinity unique, almighty, eternal universe, and ineffable, that revealed itself throughout nature, but whose splendid and energetic manifestation was the sun. Isn't that amazing? That, can I just read that last sentence where he just put it all together? The systems outlined by Pythagoras, refined by Plato and Aristotle, given final form by Hipparchus and recorded by Ptolemy. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that a beautiful sentence? That's a great sentence. The way these astronomies describe the sun chimed in almost perfect with how the Church, appropriating solar imagery, wanted its believers to see the Christian God. This cumulative reading of the universe afforded far more to Christianity than merely a legacy of pagan festivals and symbols. To arrive at the Christian monotheism, continues Collett, only one final tie had to be broken, that is to say, the supreme being residing in a distant heaven had to be removed beyond the world. The various cults devoted to the sun not only made straight roads for Christianity, they heralded its triumph. Little wonder that for the next 1,400 years the Church and State should combine so effectively to keep man's understanding of the universe exactly where the Greeks had left it. Well, this is a brilliantly written chapter. Thanks a lot for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.